New World Witchery is possible thanks to the generous support of our sponsors. We'd like to take a moment to recognize our producer-level Patreon supporters. Heather, Wisdom Queen.
Regina, Jen Rue of Rue and Hyssop.
Little Wren, Christopher.
Akia Bran van Sienak, Victoria of the Distelfink Sipshaft of Eglova.
Jonathan at the Modern Southern Polytheist. Catherine.
Carol, Deborah.
Montine. Sonara at theauburnsky.com.
Wicked Sense Etsy Shop. Moma Sarah at Conjure Cardea.
Jody. Josette.
Amy. Tanner.
Sherry. And Athena Beth. To show your support, keep the show going, please consider visiting patreon.com/newworldwitchery and pledging $1 a month or whatever you can. And as always, thanks to all of our listeners.
Hi there, I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane. If y'all are looking for a little American magic,
then put away your athames and wands and dig out your box of roots, stones, and bones.
This is New World Witchery.
This time around, we're chatting with author and talisman maker Aidan Wachter about his workshop, chaos magic, the importance of breath, and dirt sorcery. What is generally important is to build a practice of asking the powers of the elements and the above and below to come into the place you inhabit when you do the work. This both forges connections with the various powers and is a request for their presence in your life. Look at it like this. If I operate within the framework of my purely material existence, then to the east is the highway, the west is the Air Force Base, to the north, the high school, and to the south is the wrong side of the tracks. The power lines are above and the pavement below. It is neither inspiring nor helpful to view things this way from a magical perspective. That it may be literally true in one world has no bearing on its usefulness from a magical perspective. The first and most important enchantment is the enchantment of the world, which by its very nature is also the enchantment of us, its perceiver. A large amount of the work of magic and sorcery as I've come to know it has to do with this concept, by starting with the decision that there is at the very least the possibility of magic, of elemental powers, and of other realms above and below, I begin to load the world I inhabit with possibilities. If there is a place of power called North that I can look towards, that I know a little about, its relation to Earth, its nature as a cold, steady, calming, grounded place, then I have the possibility of traveling to that place. I have the possibility of drawing things to me from that place. I have the possibility of making contact with those who inhabit that place. I have the possibility of mutual aid with those beings. Multiply this by the six ways, and I have many options for learning, aid, exploration, ways of thinking, and ways of being. That passage from Aidan Wachter's Six Ways, Approaches and Entries for Practical Magic, is a remarkable one, like so many passages in that book. If you haven't yet heard about this book, Six Ways, you probably will. It's probably going to show up somewhere along the line in your social media feed, in your book recommendations, because it is getting a decent amount of buzz for being a very novel, interesting, and unorthodox approach to the prospect of magic and sorcery as something that you can get your hands on, that you can explore on your own, but not necessarily something that is just made up as you go, something that is actually rooted in some way, something that comes from years of practice and from strongly built relationships. We had the great pleasure and honor of being able to talk to the author of that book, Aidan Wachter. Now, I know Aidan really through mutual friends more than anything else, but we've also had some good social interactions here and there, mostly via social media, of course. And over the years, I've come to know Aidan as a brilliant resource in terms of his knowledge, in terms of magic, traditional witchcraft, chaos magic, folk magic, and especially talismanic magic, because he is also a talisman crafter. He makes some incredibly beautiful jewelry out of silver that is imbued with deep talismanic properties, and he does a lot of sigil work and things like that. He just wrote this book, Six Ways, this year, and published it, and like I said, it's already kind of generating a lot of buzz. It's something I think is really, really useful for our audience to know about. We did a review of it on our website as well, and I wanted to bring him to you because one of the things that's really remarkable about what Aidan's doing is he's addressing magic as something that is both transcendent of place and something that can be brought in line with the place where you live. And his practices are deeply influenced by a lot of sort of New World traditions around him, not the least of which are folk magic practices like hoodoo and curanderismo, sort of based on where he is regionally, but also these sort of cosmological structures that are sort of built into the life journey he's had. He's going to tell you a lot more about that than I can, and the interview is really, really rich, fascinating interview that I think you'll enjoy. So I wanted to share a little bit of the book with you. I'll come back and share a little bit more with you after the interview itself. But for now, I hope that you'll make some time to sit and listen and hear some of the things that Aidan has to say about what he calls dirt sorcery, which I just love that. So without further ado, then, here's the interview. All right, our guest today is Aidan Wachter. Aidan is the author of Six Ways, Approaches and Entries for Practical Magic, which he just released this year. And he is also a gifted and talented silversmith and talisman crafter. You can find his work at aidanwachter.com. We're here today to talk to him about his book, about his work, about his life, and about his magic. So Aidan, welcome to New World Witchery.
Thank you, Corey. It's a pleasure to be here.
I'm so glad that that we finally get to have you on. We've sort of known about each other, and I've known about you for quite a long time. I know you're very well respected in the magical community, especially given your incredibly fine silversmith work and your work crafting these talismans that you've been making for about almost 10 years now, isn't it?
I've been publicly doing it again since, I think, 2013. I think I started again in 2012.
Okay.
But yeah, and then I did it previously in the 90s.
And I know that those that's been kind of one of the main things that people have known you for are those talismans. But then this year you've released your book, Six Ways, which you describe as approaches and entries for practical magic. And I really enjoy that description because you're not necessarily prescribing one path that fits all, or even necessarily saying, it's not even a choose your own adventure sort of situation. You're saying there are a lot of gateways, there are a lot of doors that people can go through, and you're simply presenting ones that you have found effective, that you have found workable, and I appreciate that. Let's start, though, with maybe how you kind of came to be the magician and the craftsperson that you are. You describe in your book a path that's not really a straight line. It's a lot of curves, a lot of movement, but eventually it kind of gets you to where you are now. What drew you into the study and practice of folk magic specifically?
I think when I got, this is always such a weird one, and I like that you added the folk magic bit, because it's one of those things that I don't specifically tend to link as much to, but I'm really aware that it's a huge presence for me, mm-hmm. Kind of the way that I tend to not self-describe as a witch, though I do a lot of witchcraft, right? These things mean a lot to some people and they mean different things to me, but, I had some really strange experiences as a young person, where I saw different beings and different kind of entities, and they were usually pretty unpleasant. And over time that kind of intensified, as I got kind of into my late teens. And I'd met some witches that were kind of on the edge of old Wicca, Paul Husson kind of traditional witchcraft, who also happen to be Native Americans. Mm-hmm. And ceremonial magicians, and then Wiccans, and some druids, and things like that. And those approaches always seemed a little convoluted to me, in that they just didn't make a lot of sense. And so I kind of started noticing that the things that made sense was when I was reading books on shamanism or on folk magic, and kind of what we tend to think now as kind of primitive sorcery or low magic, if we're going to use that kind of terminology, though I really don't. Right. And that stuff all made perfect sense. And I think a lot of that was because it seemed like, at least in the ceremonial stuff, the beginning focus was to kind of get you to have a solid experience with the spirits, but in this really controlled fashion. Whereas I had like a really solid experience with them, but I wanted to get it a little under control. I didn't want to kind of force it anywhere, but I did want to be able to kind of have some volume controls, or when things got harsh, because they did early on for me a lot, to be able to back that stuff down. And that kind of led me to the approach that I use now, I would say.
And so where did talisman crafting fit into that for you? So, and why did you choose, you know, maybe silver and metallurgy as opposed to something else like fabric or wood when it came to doing talismans?
I actually had been doing them in wood since the late 80s. I was involved with the Temple of Psychic Youth, starting around 87, though they were really the first magical group that I ever kind of had real contact with in 82. And I kind of began using hybrids of their approach and Austin Spare's approach to sigil magic. But at some point I realized that I was getting much better results if I was actually generating a pretty serious material base. Mm-hmm. And so at that point I had begun carving a lot of these things. In the early 90s, I moved to New Orleans and met Mark DeFreitz and Pamela Daly, who ran at that time what was Daly and DeFreitz Jewelers. And Mark was a symbolic jeweler and made some pagan stuff and goddess stuff at that time. And I kind of egged him on to making more kind of left-hand path things, mm-hmm. which went really well. And I was a chaos magician at that time, and so chaos stuff. And some years later, I learned how to make jewelry from him, and it just clicked instantly. It was one of those things, you know, there's a lot of things that you learn that are really hard to learn to do for you. Mm-hmm. Or at least this has been my experience. And jewelry is one of the few that's not been the case. Like, as soon as I got a hold of a saw and some silver, I could make jewelry pretty well. And then that kind of just, you know, exponentially improved. There's something there that I think is innate. I don't know what that is though.
That's interesting. So it was almost sort of tapping it as opposed to learning it in some ways.
Yeah. It's probably the only thing that in my life I've really had that experience with, that it's like, oh yeah, I just watching him make stuff is how I learned. He didn't really outright teach me. I had him show me if there's anything I need to be aware of with the saw, show me if there's anything I need to be aware of with the solder. And that was about it, but he was great. So just being able to sit and watch him when I wasn't, you know, polishing stuff for him or whatever, is really where I kind of went, okay, I can do all this stuff. I'm not as well as he could at that time, but, I knew I could do it. There was no question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I mean, it's definitely developed into, I mean, I think people who have seen or held your, jewelry know it's a really, really high quality of craftsmanship. It's not, you know, it's not something that's, you know, you're going to find in the catalog of Azure Green or something like that, that's been, you know, mass produced somewhere. It's very, very particular and very individual. And, it sort of resonates, with the kind of quality that you put into it.
I hope so. That's certainly the intention.
Well, good. What about the process for actually creating the talismanic images themselves? How does that work for you? You know, where did some of these images come from? Are they client derived, or are they things that you are generating from within you, things you've worked with before? So how does that work for you?
Most of them are kind of self-derived. And again, if I were to kind of have to peg one thing, I'm very much a sigil magician. Mm-hmm. In that that's the one thing that's always present. You know, it's not the only thing or even the main thing, but that's always there. It was kind of interesting. In the last couple of years, at some point, I had this memory of doodling in my school books. And though I've never been a good kind of realist, mm-hmm. hand drawer, like, I can't draw you a tree that looks like a tree unless I really take time at it. I realized I've always had that kind of design approach. Mm-hmm. So it's a merger of the sigil work, rune work, in a lot of cases. And then working with the spirits for the stuff that goes into the shop designs, I'll usually get a hit from someone going, I want something. I would like you to offer something, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it's just a process of sitting with pen and paper or design program and trying to kind of channel that and go, what do we think about this, and see if we get anywhere. And sometimes it's pretty clear and easy, and sometimes it's one of those things where you come back and 2 years later it finally pops. And definitely some of them do come out where customers come in and go, I'm interested in this type of thing. And if it's not specifically something that they want as a custom piece, and it kind of resonates, then we'll see if there's a way to make it into a shop piece that works for them and I think might work for other people. And then, obviously I have a very good relationship with, Robin Artisan, who approached me, on several occasions to see if I would offer some of the designs from his works, for the people that are working with his stuff. And that's been awesome fun. We have one piece done that I hope I will get the green light to release the pictures of pretty soon.
Very, very cool. That's, yeah. And it's interesting. You mentioned Robin Artisan, and you've had these other kind of threads and connections kind of coming from your past chaos magic. Even sort of the connection to, as you're saying, the Paul Hewson sort of inflected forms of traditional witchcraft and things like that. There's a lot of pieces kind of coming together, to make you who you are now. And I know you currently live in the southwestern region of the United States, if I'm not mistaken.
Yep.
And that's an area where there's just a lot of cultural contact. There's a lot of those threads, you know, coming together or pulling apart at times. How does that landscape, you know, the physical environment and the people to some extent, how does that shape your practice?
It's pretty interesting because I honestly hadn't been thinking about it a lot, but since the book came out, I've been getting asked about it a lot. So it's kind of sending me down that hole more, perhaps. I'm pretty reclusive, and so it's not uncommon for me to not actually leave, you know, my property unless it's to go walk for a couple miles or something. Sometimes every 2 months I'll leave the property. But, you know, more like once a month I get out. And so I don't have a huge lot of contact with the people here, but it is a really interesting vibe, I think. And I think it's a weird one. I was thinking about it this morning because I kind of knew you would probably go here. It's a different colonization that happened here than most of the, you know, the Northeast or the East or even the West. And I think that it has really put an imprint on this place, there's still the Spanish hierarchy, right, is really present. And the desert areas to me are very quiet compared to, like, we were in Tennessee before this, and that's really active, kind of as far as land spirit energy. It's really surface. It's really kind of ready. It's really kind of trippy. And that's at least my experience of that kind of heavy hardwood forest. Whereas here it's much more about the kind of air and the wind and the sky. For me, the biggest thing probably is that we live in an amazing animal zone, and I'm super, that's kind of my thing. And so there's a, you know, coyotes that walk through our property and stay on the other side of the electric fence from our livestock, mostly because we've got really big dogs and the electric fence. But, you know, I love the fact that sometimes one of my big dogs will be yipping at something. And I know that that's either that one of the neighbor's little tiny dogs has snuck through the fence or one of the coyotes has come through a hole somewhere. And often you'll see the coyotes just hanging out with her. There's a million ravens on this property and immediately around. So they keep the major predators off, which is good for our livestock and our chickens. But there's tons of hawks. There's eagles. There's a lot of small falcons. And a gazillion songbirds. And all of that to me feels great. I love the openness. I love just the vibrance and the fact that, you know, we've got water and food out for the chickens, and that's drawn everybody and his brother into here. That to me just feels normal. And is more so that than anywhere else I've ever been. Tennessee was like that. We were really rural in Tennessee. But I don't do well with the humidity, so it was harder to enjoy that.
The air definitely sort of sweats for you in the South.
Yeah, it does. we learned from one of the guys that we met there. I don't remember it now, but he taught us the Spanish for my sweat is sweating. But, you know, it's interesting. I've spent some time in the Guadalupe Shrine up in Santa Fe, which is super old, and that's a crazy intense place. That's probably the most intense human derived power spot I've ever been in. And that's, that was different. I've spent a lot of time in Catholic churches just cause I like them. But that was an entirely different universe. But it's, you know, it's, if we view it kind of from the folk or the magical or religious aspects of, especially kind of Spanish influenced, and, you know, India and Mexican influenced, Catholicism, that place has been a working temple for 400 years, mm-hmm. Where people are bringing all of their problems and all of their hopes to, and you can tell it's a heavy, heavy zone. So it's an interesting thing. So I don't know if that answers your question, but
no, it's certainly, I get a good sense of that. And one of the things that you mentioned in discussing that is that you're talking about sort of the openness and the space, and it sort of brings to mind this idea of, you know, there's air all around you. And you know, and I understand, you know, in Tennessee, in the South, and places where I've lived, and, you know, even in Pennsylvania where I currently reside, you know, there's definitely, you know, greenery and there's a sort of breathing landscape, but there is there's a difference in sort of the way the landscape breathes, in those places and the landscape that you describe. And breath is something in your book that is really, really important. You talk a lot about breath in six ways. Why do you think that practice of breathing, that air is so central or so important to magic?
Because I think it's something that we just forgot in the West. And I think that comes around through at least the weird kind of Protestant influences of what is proper and upright and how composed you have to be. Mm-hmm. All of those things kind of teach you to restrict your breathing. And I think if we look at even the guys that I know that do bow hunting, mm-hmm. like they don't breathe like other people if they're very good at it. Or some of the special forces guys that I've known are the same way. Because you can't, because you let everybody know where you are, right? So you learn how to breathe very deeply and very calmly and very quietly and very efficiently. And this also is kind of, it changes your bodily responses to stress and quiets you down, and you become quieter to those other things that you maybe don't want to notice you, right? Be those animals or humans or whatever, so that you can be closer to them and not be detected. And I think that was probably a natural habit for, you know, humans for a million years or so, that we just kind of walked out of. So to me, it's not anything special. It's a remembering how you're supposed to be. Hmm. And if you aren't doing that to some degree, whether intentionally or just because of, you know, there's a lot of runners and things like that who I think learn that stuff too. Mm-hmm. Then you're not actually functioning very well. Your body's probably carrying more stress than it should. Your mind is probably running around more than it should, talking shit as minds like to. And it's just so there's that side of it. And then practically it's the best way to get control of your mind and get control of your body. You know, it's the ability to breathe and slow your heart rate and to, again, kind of chill out all those fight or flight responses that get kicked up by our society's kind of continuous button pushing. Mm-hmm. Allows you to have a much better sense of who you are and where you are and what's actually happening, and not your kind of fantasies or delusions or yours or the projections of, you know, Twitter. which are all just, you know, they're buttons that are producing chemical and energetic responses in us. So breath is the main tool to get through that stuff really easily.
Mm. That's, yeah, I like the way you put that. And then thinking also about that, the same sort of landscape, the landscape that you talk about in Six Ways is, it's not necessarily the physical landscape that you're focused on. It's something that you call the field. It's this, I don't know if you would describe it as a landscape, but I sort of saw it as an extended realm of magic, but it's not entirely separate from our own realm. Can you maybe elaborate a little bit on how you see the magical and the mundane world interacting in that way?
Sure. And I have to kind of go back to bagging on the Protestants, but, you know, between the Protestants and the Industrial Revolution, or if we want to go back a little further, to the kind of invention of grain agriculture and the rise of the city states, I think we've been moving further and further away from what I think is reality, by stratifying, because all of these things allow you to kind of ignore what is really going on. From agriculture on to, you know, computers. And so the field to me is everything that is and everything that could become, right? Mm-hmm. So that's why I refer to it as being the whole of manifest and unmanifest reality. And so kind of the wake world that we wander around in physically, to me is just a somewhat small piece of that. It's not in any way that it's not important, because we're having this experience through our bodies, so it's critically important, but it's kind of it's information dense enough that we can forget all the other information that's available to us if we take the time to kind of learn how to do that, or as I think it is, more remember how to do that. And so they're not separate. It's more like it's massive in interpenetration, and I think everyone is kind of on a spectrum. You know, I'm somewhere on that spectrum between operating within those two realms, though it's not really two, but for lack of a better way of viewing it, and I'm switching all the time, right? Mm-hmm. I'm shifting depending on what I'm doing between a mostly mundane wake world experience to a mostly other world experience. And to me, it's really important. Probably the biggest thing in magic is learning how to, for each of us, how we operate in those kind of, again, synthetically two sides of reality.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you mentioned earlier the idea of sort of being spirit led and spirit guided in your work. And I remember in the book, you kind of talk about being in that space as being a sort of communion experience with spirits as well. Do you feel like that is something else that you see has been lost sort of in this ever more industrial arc of quote unquote civilization? Is this sort of diminishment of relationships with things that aren't tangible, but are real in some way.
Totally. Yeah, I think that that's the... And to me, it's funny. It's I try not to do this because people get to take it the wrong way, but I always want to kind of scream about the concept of occultism, because it really should be like, I can't see-ism, right? It's like a disability that I think a huge number of us have, at least in the West, that it's like we've lost, you know, half of our vision and half of our hearing and half of our sense of taste and half of our sense of smell. And that is an abnormality to me. I don't think that that's where we came from. Because I think we would have been tanking it just as fast at any previous point if that was true, as we have been for the last, you know, few hundred years as a species. Because I don't know that you can be functional without it. So to me, kind of the what I think of as kind of the magical or sorceress or spirit view of things is really trying to get back to baseline for humans.
Well, in that way, maybe kind of magic becomes a coping mechanism, or that even that seems a little off, but it's sort of a tool that we use to balance out the missing pieces. I kind of like that. And you talk about, you said, the idea of, you know, occultism, and I can't see ism. I think that's fantastic. One of the things I often hear when people talk about occultism is this idea that it is all these secrets, these things that are hidden away, even the word occult kind of meaning, secreted or hidden away. But that's not kind of the magic that you talk about in Six Ways. And really, it's not the kind of magic that I see so pervasively throughout folk magical culture. In a lot of situations, what we're really seeing is magic that is right there out in the open, maybe in another way of thinking about it, hidden in plain sight. And you have a way of talking about this that I really love, which is that it's dirt sorcery. You know, that this is something that is under your fingernails and on your skin. And I love that. Can you explain a little more? What do you mean by that term? What is a dirt sorcerer? What can they offer the modern world?
I talk about it in the book, but I was hanging out. I was actually living in an OTO lodge at one point, and I'd already kind of started sliding pretty deep into the chaos stuff and other things. And what I found is that I could do some ceremonial magic stuff. I did some of the, you know, Golden Dawny curly stuff and got some results from it, but it always seemed a little skewed. And when I really needed something done, that's when I tended to bust out the pocket knife and go and, you know, cut a stick off of a fruit tree or something. And, begin trying to make the thing that would help me and viewing that as really the spirit tool, right? I just had the sense that I should be able to, if I could kind of make the right house for something that would help me, it should, if it was willing, and I didn't want to work with anything that wasn't willing, I wasn't interested in coercion, kind of come to play. And then we could have a relationship. And so dirt sorcery is the name I came up for it, mostly to kind of shut down. People would be like, you know, wanting to talk about, you know, convoluted tesseracts. New guy who was really into tesseract magic. Great guy. Somebody I really loved who's gone. But and I was just like, dude, I don't understand even the concept of why that would be helpful to me. You know, and I was never able to get that on a lot of stuff, whereas I could, as I said, kind of carve a form into a stick or carve sigils into a stick and perhaps bury it in a location or bleed on it a bit or something, you know, and then kind of treat it as if it was the spirit itself. And these things really did bring about pretty radical change for me. And that's more or less still what I do. I don't bleed as much anymore. That was a psychic youth derived thing.
And then so like, and then so what is, you know, what do you see as kind of the dirt sorcery's place in the modern world? Is it, I think people, you know, when they think about folk magic, a lot of times they'll think about something that was done a long time ago, or, you know, that belonged in, you know, the 19th century or something like that. But I mean, you're still practicing this stuff. This still is alive and well with you. And I mean, I know from my experience, it's alive and well in a lot of places. So it clearly has something to offer. What do you think that is?
You know, I have I'm going to digress a little bit to get to where we're going, but
no, it's perfect. I love winding paths. So.
I have like a really peculiar, I think, and apparently from what I hear, view of chaos magic. So a lot of people think of chaos magic as kind of like the free belief practices, or believe whatever you want to believe, or, you know, see if you can get a spirit to inhabit your Ultraman, or, you know, Godzilla toy or whatever, or the kind of more Pete Carroll quantum physics based. Here's some pretty complex theories about how all these things could work, right? Whereas what I saw chaos magic was it seemed like this group of people had begun to realize, like, there's something in almost every kind of magic you can do that will work, right? Mm-hmm. And it may not actually be necessary that you buy the whole package, right? If you want the shoelaces from that one pair of shoes, you could maybe just buy those, you know, use those shoelaces. You don't actually have to wear those shoes because you like the shoelaces. And I think what I began to see as I was writing the book, and the Allies were heavily involved in the writing of the book. They were the first editors. And what I thought a lot while I was working on it, and what has been really great feedback to get, because you never know until it's out there, is that a lot of people naturally do magic. Mm-hmm. But because of kind of the codification of, are you a folk magician? Are you OTO? Are you Golden Dawn? Are you Gardnerian Wicca? Or whatever. Mm-hmm. It's kind of assumed that you have to buy the whole package to do the work. And so to me, kind of the approach with Six Ways in particular was saying that's really never been true. There's specific traditions, right? If you're looking at Lukumi or, you know, mostly that I'm aware of, mostly are ATRs, that are codified religious processes that have magical components. But as far as magic itself, I think it's way more open. And so that was kind of what I was trying to bring to it, is showing like you can kind of, if you're working consciously and working with some integrity and trying to build relationships and not burning your kind of spiritual bridges and not, you know, just being a spaz to see what you can generate. And I definitely did some of that, and I paid for it. But actually, if you can kind of honestly walk into whatever your sacred space is, and whether that be a mind space or a physical space or the graveyard or the hillside, and say, these are the things that I'm having difficulties with, or I would like help with, can I get assistance, and go through that kind of processing of asking and making offerings and doing the things that actually help kind of have a physical manifestation of most of these things, which is the whole process of material bases, it works. And it super doesn't matter whether you can define it or whether it's okay in your branch of witchcraft, or if it's okay in your branch of Buddhism, or if it's okay in your branch of Catholicism. It's just available. This is, again, it's a natural process. And a lot of the trappings that we put on it, a lot of the clothes that we put on it, make it, I won't say needlessly complex, because I think some people need the complexity, but not necessarily complex or particularly intellectually deep. It's like, can you just get really real with your allies And that to me is also how you find your allies, is can you get really honest and really real? Because if you aren't, it's like anybody else. They're not going to give you the time of day, in my experience. Or instead, you're going to get really shitty ones that are like freeloaders. Like, yeah, I'll help you out for now, but I'm going to kind of attach to you and see what I can get over the long time, lead you along. And there's a lot of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, I don't want to necessarily, you know, bash on occultists who do need that ceremony. Like you were saying, there are people who function better with the higher, I hate using the term high and low magic, but using those kind of more ornate and elaborate ceremonies. And I think there are spirits that probably get something out of that too. So, I mean, I'm not
knocking that. Absolutely. But, I don't knock it at all. It's just, yeah. I don't think it's absolutely necessary.
Exactly. Yeah. Well, so Six Ways has been immensely well received. I've seen tons of people talking about it. It's got a lot of buzz going on. I know you're always busy with new talismans. Do you have any plans with, you know, follow-ups of more books or other projects in the future that you're looking forward to?
You know, I created the Six Ways Facebook group before the book came out to kind of have a single place to chat about the stuff. So it wasn't necessarily flooding both the kind of more personal screwing around and sharing music and chicken pictures end of things or the talismanic end for the folks that weren't super interested. And I've had a lot of requests from that to kind of provide some more help on the trance induction stuff. And so that's the next kind of project, is going to be some audio files to get into the spaces that are discussed there. And I'm just trying to figure out, how can I get people in and deep enough without turning it into just a guided meditation?
Right.
Because that's not at all my intention. But I did have to kind of do something like that for myself early on. I didn't need a lot of help, but I needed a little bit of help. And so that's kind of the next thing there. And then there's a whole series of practices that come out of the trance work that I was given in the last year. And I'm trying to figure out what format to share those in. And those may be classes, you know, online classes or something, because I'm not really sure how to do it otherwise. Mm-hmm. I could write it. You know, I've tried to write it, but it's one of those things that I think people kind of probably have to see my face to really get it. That's why there's a lot of videos on that Six Ways group, is I think it's just much easier to come across. It's, not that I'm always coherent, but I think that that still works even when I'm not, cause this is not necessarily stuff that is totally coherent, seeming on the surface, you know, on the inside it is, I think, but mm-hmm. it's not super relatable all the time to the wake world.
Mm-hmm. No, it's sort of a liminal experience in and of itself, I think.
Yeah, totally.
And, you know, it's also, you know, as much as we've sat here and sort of, you know, tutted our tongues a little bit about the Industrial Revolution, it is nice to live in an age where so many people can be connected and, you know, share some of these experiences through things like the video medium and be able to have access to things that might not have been possible before. So there's some good to that. And I'm glad to see that you're doing that and making that available to people, too.
Oh, absolutely. I think that it is. It's one of those really weird ones, because you go, this is like that super toxic medicine, and we haven't figured out how to balance the dose yet.
Right.
And I don't think that means we can't figure that out. But, you know, we're in the phase where we're still losing a lot of patients.
this is clinical trials.
Yeah. You signed the waiver.
Well, Aidan, thank you so much. I really appreciate you making the time to talk to us today. If people want to get in touch with you, I know we've got the website. We'll link to that in the show notes. Are there other ways that people can reach out to you if they're interested?
Yeah, I'm Aidan Wachter on Facebook, Aidan Wachter on Instagram, and you can find all that stuff through any kind of portal there. All the links are everywhere. But if you do a search for Aidan Wachter Six Ways or Aidan Wachter Talismanic Jeweler, you'll find all that stuff.
Perfect. Perfect. Well, again, thank you so much. This was a total delight to be able to have you on this time. And hopefully people will go out there and read your book, because I think it will definitely open some eyes, maybe bust a few heads on the way and do some good work. And I appreciate what you've done. So thank you.
Thank you. I hope that's what it does. And thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Thank you so much. Have a great day.
You too, Corey.
Bye.
Sacred fear. There is a type of fear that is holy. Holy terror or sacred fear comes to some, everyone who will open to it, I believe, at moments in the practice of sorcery. Sometimes it is a warning. Really? You want to go here? Sometimes it is a meeting with a power that is so present and so much other that the senses rebel and recoil at the presence. The main thing to understand is that this kind of fear is information. It is related to the fear when a rattlesnake rattles nearby, or you see a mountain lion on a ledge not very far from you, watching. This kind of fear is a natural response to particular kinds of power. It is not necessarily a response to an actual threat. I remember a time in the high mountains near Mount Shasta, where I came upon a snowmelt lake right at the tree line. I slept near the lake and awoke to this kind of terror. I lay in my sleeping bag inside my tent, holding tight to an earlier incarnation of the Finnish knife, shaking. I could hear the breath of a big animal right outside the tent. In time, it settled into a purr, and what seemed like hours later, I realized it had moved off. I made myself get up, get dressed, and leave the tent while it was still dark. The world was electric with power, the stars biting clear up there around 10,000 feet. After a while, still terror-ridden, I walked to the edge of the Snowmelt Lake. The stars were reflected in the water, but there were other lights there, moving. These were flashes like lightning, bolt blue, rising from the lake bottom to the surface, hundreds of them, over and over. The terror shifted to awe, and then to fascination. I sat and watched the witch lights in the water until dawn when they faded. In the growing light, I saw movement on the other side of the lake. The mountain lion who had awoken me to see this sight moving down the mountain in the morning light. You may encounter this kind of fear out and about in the world, or at your altar, or in your bed. In most cases, it is information. Listen, perceive to the best of your ability to what the information is telling you. It may be a transmission of power, and it may be a warning. Some people should not enter some places. Just as there are healing, helpful places of power, so are there hurtful ones. Sometimes the fear is telling you, get ready, get into your power, this is a rough space and you need to be awake. And sometimes it is telling you that you don't belong, and you best get your ass home while it is all in one piece. No one else can interpret these things for you. One other bit of fear-related thought. If you practice magic, over time you begin to be recognized by the others. The work will make you more interesting to them, and not just the helpful, friendly ones. Not all of this attention will be welcome. Do the work suggested in the Stay Clean chapter, and understand that while the individual instance may not be pleasant and may produce effects that need to be handled, this is a side effect that comes from actually doing the work. It is not a bad thing any more than a virus, or a broken bone, or getting too close to a strange dog's home is a bad thing. These are natural events, even if unpleasant or scary. I can't tell you what to do with any of these kinds of fear, only that they are not uncommon. Remember that they are information, dense reactions to power, and will need to be addressed according to each particular person and situation. We'd like to thank Aiden for coming on our show, sharing with us his work, sharing with us his life, his story, how he came to his practice, and sharing with us a little bit of Six Ways. We really appreciate the chance to share that book with you, and we hope that what you hear in that conversation is a sense of magical practice as a journey. When we think about North American folk magic, one of the things that I like to sort of put into perspective is the fact that North America is huge. It's an enormous expanse with a lot of different places to explore, a lot of different things to encounter. And while I wouldn't recommend for a second that you go out and cherry pick and appropriate other people's cultures or other people's cultural practices, you can learn from the journey. You can learn from all of the places that we have access to here. This is a land where a diverse, divergent, and convergent set of practices have found a home, and they bleed into one another, they influence one another, they develop and build into practices that you may never encounter, or that you may encounter on a daily basis, depending on where you are, but that are influenced by practices from all over the world, all over the country as well. So it's worth it to me to hear stories like Aiden's, because this kind of magical practice and what we see sort of in the new world, the new world backdrop, is one of synthesis, one of creation, one of tradition and roots, but one of tradition and roots that adapt and change to changing conditions. We are in a very powerful, living, breathing, folk magical world, and our particular piece of that folk magical world is one of the most dynamic and interesting anywhere. So I hope that talking with Aiden has sort of opened that up a little bit. I do highly recommend that you check out Six Ways. You can read our review of that. I'll put a link to that in the show notes as well. If you have thoughts on this or any other episode, if you want to share your ideas with us, you can do so by going to our website, which is newworldwitchery.com, or emailing us at compassandkey@gmail.com. I should also say, if you like what you heard from the book, if you're interested in the book, you probably will be interested to know about the contest we've got going on. This episode is going up in August 2018, and in that same month, we have a contest going on where you can send us your graveyard lore. We're trying to collect a bunch of graveyard and cemetery lore for a future episode, which, as you probably guessed, is going to be airing in October. It's the appropriate time for that, I think. And when we talk about graveyard lore, it could be lore having to do with local haunts, specters, spooks, monsters, things that inhabit your nearby graveyards. We'd love to hear that. We'd love to hear about graveyard practices and traditions that you know about. So, for example, leaving certain things on certain types of graves might be important, or the orientation or direction of certain graves, symbols on gravestones, things like that. We'd love to hear what you know about those. Or if you use graveyards in your magical practice. Some people, for example, use graveyard dirt. Some people may simply use the gates of the graveyard as sort of a sacred place to do rituals or spells. Whatever you do, we'd love to hear about that. Make sure that you're okay sharing whatever information it is with us and with the broader world, because we'll use it in our show and possibly in future projects. Send us your graveyard lore at compassandkey@gmail.com, or you can leave it on our hotline as a voicemail at 442-999-4824. That's 442-99-WITCH. We love to have your voicemails because we love incorporating those in the show. Do send us the lore. Make sure you also give us a name we can use on the air that we can broadcast, and give us a general location. It doesn't have to be, you know, the street where you live. It can just be something general like, you know, I'm in southern Alabama, or I'm in the Pacific Northwest, something like that. That's perfectly acceptable when that's really all we're looking for. You can send in your graveyard lore, get an entry into the contest, and win one of two prize packs that we've got. The first prize pack we're calling the Wild Magic Prize Pack, which includes a copy of Aiden's book, as well as a really beautiful poster print of a poem by Tom Hirons called Sometimes a Wild God, which is illustrated by folk artist Rima Staines, and a bottle of oil, Abra Camino oil from Conjured Cardia as well, plus some other little bits and bobs. We also have a Hills and Hollers pack, which includes a book on Appalachian mountain folklore, including magical folklore, by Nancy Richmond and Misty Murray Walker. And then we'll have the two first volumes of Cullen Bunn's graphic novel series called Harrow County, which is amazing and super spooky. And then a book of mountain holiday lore called A Foxfire Christmas from the Foxfire publication groups, and some other stuff in that pack as well. So you can win one of those two packs by getting your name in the hat. If you don't happen to have graveyard lore,
That's fine. You don't necessarily have to have graveyard lore. We understand some people are like, I really want to enter this contest, but I have no idea what graveyard lore I would submit. That's fine. There are other ways to enter. One, if you're a Patreon supporter of any kind, you're automatically entered. You get an entry just for being our supporter on Patreon. So if you already pledge $1 a month or anywhere north of that, you're already entered. You can head over to our YouTube channel and subscribe. If you do that, we're going to be sort of pulling a list of all of our subscribers once the contest is over. And if you win, we'll let you know. We do, you know, ask that you somehow indicate to us how we can get in touch with you. When we announce that, we'll want to find out a way to get in touch with you if you win because you're on our YouTube channel. Another way that you can get your name in the hat is if you just share your favorite piece of New World Witchery. This could be an episode you really liked. It could be an article that you really enjoyed that we put up on our website. You know, anything like that. Maybe a video from our YouTube channel if you want to do that. Share it on some sort of social media. It can be Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, whatever you use. Share it and make sure you tag us. You know, use the @ or the hashtag, whatever you need to do to tag us. And let us know that you're sharing this. If you share on a platform that we're not on, so you can't tag us, just email us to let us know where you shared us and what article you shared or whatever you shared so that we can enter you into the drawing there as well. And you can do any of those things. That'll get you an entry as well. You can actually do all of those things. Each of those things counts for an entry, so you can get multiple entries for this contest as well if you want to do that and increase your chances of getting one of those two cool prize packs. So we've got that contest going on. We're going to try and close that up on September 1st. So get your entries in before that, September 1st, 2018. We hope that you will send us some graveyard lore because we'd love to share that with you and with everyone else. As I said, you can find us at our website, newworldwitchery.com, and I've given you our email address several times. That voicemail line, 442-999-4824, is good for more than just the graveyard lore. Certainly feel free to do graveyard lore there, but give any feedback you want there. We love having feedback from you there as well. As I said, you can find us on Twitter, you can find us on Instagram, you can find us on Facebook. We are on... Oh, goodness gracious, where else are we? I think we're on Pinterest as well. All sorts of places that you can track us down. And YouTube, we have launched a YouTube channel where you can catch old episodes that we're converting into kind of... there's not really video to watch, but sound. You know, the sound is there in the video if you prefer to watch or listen to podcasts that way. And some fun informational videos. I actually did a contest announcement for the contest I just mentioned as a video on our YouTube channel, so you can if you want to haunt your dreams, you can you can actually see what I look like if you've never done that before. So so find us on YouTube as well. I think that'll about do it. We do also want to let you know we've got an Audible trial program set up. So if you visit audibletrial.com/newworldwitchery, you can get a free trial of Audible. They've got almost 200,000 titles, including several that I actually narrate. So if you do the Audible trial, that helps support the show. If you buy a title from Audible, that helps support me if I'm the one narrating it. So that's kind of cool, too. And you are not obligated to continue after the free trial. So don't feel like you have to stick with it. If you do, though, there's definitely a lot of cool stuff on there. And... I think that's about it for this time around. If you do have questions, we'd love to hear from you. But otherwise, thank you so much for listening and be well.